Continuing with John Baldwin on 9 June 1981. Yes, David Dewhurst.
Yes, I think he was quite important. In, he was the one contact we had with optical astronomy who would tell us about things that we had not much idea about. And so that, well, in the case of IC-443, as soon as he would be the person I would go to and say, what does this atlas mean? What are these objects? What does it mean? What is a nebula? Things like that. And he was involved with John Shakeshaft in the when they began to think about the identifications in 2C. And they did quite a bit of work on that, but didn't actually lead to publication, whether it got overtaken by events on 3C or what, I don't know now.
Yeah.
And so what else did he do? He must have been a co-author with other people on one or two papers, I suspect.
But in any case, you didn't have much contact with any other optical astronomers in any kind of regular fashion beside him?
No, I think that's right.
Not even solar astronomers?
Oh, well, I didn't, but no, there may have been contact with them. Yes, well, there were one or two solar astronomers at, at the observatories. There was von Kluber there who, so in connection with sunspots and so on, perhaps he would have been the person I'd talk to.
A general question is that I'm interested in is how synchrotron theory came to be accepted in the West. And you worked a lot, obviously, on the galactic corona and wondered about what it was, what its origin was. And for yourself, when did you become a believer, so to speak, that the background was due to synchrotron radiation?
Must have been, well, it was quite early that we were aware of it. We were aware of Alfvén and Herlofsen, and we were aware of that paper by Hutchinson as well.
That's right, 52.
And then because Peter Scheuer was working on the galactic background, looking at the H2 concentration and so on, and perhaps finding it, but that emphasised again that the rest of it wasn't thermal. I mean, that had been, I think, shown by somebody else as well. And there was the possibility it was just made up of discrete sources where one didn't know what the mechanism was anyway. But there weren't, in fact, too many other contenders. Well, I can't remember any other contenders, really.
Well, that's actually true. I mean, there wasn't any competing theory.
And therefore, although one didn't necessarily believe it, that's what the theory was, because, and therefore it was, one was moderately prepared to believe it. But on the other hand, we were very sceptical about the original observation of the optical polarization in the Crab Nebula from John Brodsky when that appeared. In my pile of Saturday morning literature sheets, I got my comments on what we said that morning, which was frank disbelief, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But that was perhaps because the Russians experimentally hadn't got a very high reputation.
Yeah. Well, it was only sort of a three-sentence report in a very short paper.
That's right. Yes, it was. So one didn't have much of the details. But that's interesting, though, because that was, that was clear evidence for synchrotron radiation, which otherwise I think we were quite prepared to believe.
But now, would you automatically transfer from synchrotron in sources to the synchrotron in the galactic background? Once you had a mechanism for the one, it was you'd go with it for the other?
Oh, I think it was more clear for the background before it was for sources in our mind, in that we'd read that and we'd read Schwinger's papers on the actual mechanism, so that was all absolutely solid physics, so you knew that happened. And one knew that in the interstellar medium there were fast particles, I mean, you knew there were cosmic rays and so on. And at that time it was also known that there were... Was it also known that there were magnetic fields? Well, Spitzer and Tukey's...
Interstellar polarization.
Interstellar polarization, yes, was... So...
It was reasonable to suppose...
It was reasonable to suppose... It wasn't a big step in thought that this could be reasonable. One didn't have much idea about the numerical values. But I think that occurred far before what actually went on in sources was really discussed, as far as I'm aware. Perhaps that because of my interest.
Well, that was 54 with the first Russian result, and then shortly followed by Orton, Walraven.
Yes, that's right.
And so forth. But it seems to me, from looking at it, that people didn't accept it in the West until even after that.
They accepted it for the Crab Nebula.
Yes, but in general.
Yes, but in general, and certainly as far as extragalactic sources were concerned, no, that... people just didn't know.
Well, for instance, you did an experiment in... published in 61 with Polinyi-Toth and Shakeshaft, looking for linear polarization in the North Polar Spur.
Ah, yes.
Now, was that... I would suspect by then that you were accepting synchrotron as the mechanism. Was this only a matter of pinning down the details, or were you still looking for some confirmation that it was synchrotron?
No, that was more to see if the if there really were large-scale fields in the galaxy, then one ought to be able to see polarization. But no, I mean, that would have been being done much earlier by... again, a search by John Thompson that must have been 55 or so.
I'm not sure if it was that early, but no. There were many searches for background polarization, you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it must have been as early as that.
But they weren't successful.
No, they weren't.
And yet one still stayed with synchrotron. Because it was the only game in town.
Yes. Yes, and it was obviously, one wasn't necessarily expecting to get very high polarizations.
Okay. Now, for radio sources, in general, even when you didn't have an optical identification, was the polarization really needed there to be convincing? You had M87 after a certain point, optically anyway.
Optically.
And then, actually, it was measured pretty... did NRL measure Virgo A also? I can't quite remember now. They measured Taurus.
Not Cygnus, didn't they? Wasn't Cygnus one of the early ones? But all this was at short wavelengths, which was quite outside our range. So...
But did you... would you say that then it might be a different mechanism at microwaves than at VHF, or in the States rather than England, or...?
No, it wasn't so much the effect that it would have on belief as whether somebody producing a result actually affects what you're going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
And that was much higher in everybody's thoughts than specific theoretical aspects. So it was synchrotron radiation in Cygnus A. Well, what about it?
Well, now that's interesting. So,
the importance of actually trying to get observations was very, very much higher in relation to that sort of idea.
Yeah.
In our group, I don't know what it was elsewhere. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that it seems to me that you were not motivated so much by the astronomy. Having a burning desire to want to know what the physics was in that source, so much as being keen to go out and get more data on it and let the things fall where they may.
Yes, not about the physics of sources. I mean, the sun had been the physics.
The structure of sources. I mean, this work you did on measuring sizes of sources and.
That's right. We were trying to say what the hell are they?
Right.
Most of these sources. Yes. Well, now, so somebody had measured some polarization, but I forget now whether it made an impact on us that this was different in any way than what had been done before. In other words, we were prepared to accept synchrotron radiation in some places. Now, looking back now, I don't know that we had at that time definitely accepted that synchrotron radiation existed in extragalactic sources, and whether that was a crucial moment when it became apparent that that was the mechanism. I mean, it was a paper I remember, so it obviously had some importance to us.
The North Polar Sphere one, you mean?
No, I meant the NRL results on polarization of Cygnus and things. But it didn't change our way of life.
Yeah, okay. Well, how would you characterize what motivates you in particular and presumably many of the group anyway, with common characteristics?
What then?
Yes.
Yes, because I mean it's
no, then.
A different world. Yeah. I think one of the main themes of the group was that these sources are extragalactic. They can be used for cosmology. We've got to find out what we can about them with the techniques that we can develop, and we felt that we were following techniques which were quite different from what other people were doing at the time, and that it was fun. That was fine. I mean, that if other people wanted to use different techniques, then let him get on with it, and let us get on with these, because we think that something interesting is actually going to emerge. And that was the driving force behind, I suppose, two-thirds of the group.
So, well, this is an astronomical motivation.
Oh, yes, it is.
It sounds like.
Yes.
But it was, as opposed to the fascination with the techniques and just can't wait to get your hands on what you can do next with the techniques and let someone else
interpret. There was definitely astronomical drive, but it wasn't concerned so much at that stage with the physics of sources, because you didn't know what sources were.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you accepted that Cygnus A was colliding galaxies or something, it was something to do with hot gas and stuff.
Right.
The rest was absolutely...
But, I mean, you, of course, yourself were greatly concerned with the distribution of the galactic background and whether there was a corona, how big it was. And you must have been somewhat concerned with the physics of what was going on in it also.
Yeah. You flatter me. I mean, I knew that cosmic rays existed. One had no idea where they came from, therefore, it was sort of primary information in a way.
So it was
is a distribution of, this is what the distribution of radio emission is like. And so that there must be, I mean, the conclusions then are that there must be these particles and there must be fields at these heights and so on. How they get there, that hardly figures. I mean, yeah, there was some discussion about that to get there, the material associated with magnetic fields would have to, you know, have high velocities, like high velocity stars in galactic halo and so on, but I don't think there was much more physical insight than that.
Well, a final question about the overall success of the group. What do you think have been the key elements in it? Has it been partly this stick-to-itiveness and ignoring what's going on outside? What do you think are the key elements?
Well, so much depends on one man, but somebody with driving intensity and a lot of ideas and the confidence to know that they could be implemented somehow. So that on the technical side, that was clearly the overriding influence. But also, I think personally, he had the ability to actually carry with him a lot of young people.
Mm-hmm.
Who became utterly absorbed in the whole game, so that in fact people were working together and were happy apparently doing so on the whole. Well, the fact is that a lot of the people are still around. They've been very static. Well, now, what are the reasons for whether Cambridge is a nice place or that they thought that the group was the right sort of way to work? I don't know.
Well, it becomes a reinforcing thing after a while, and once you have a tradition of this kind.
Yes.
I mean, is that a tradition in the Cavendish as a whole, also, that virtually all the staff are Cambridge?
Well, homegrown.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly is in some... Well, I mean, it's less so true now, but it certainly was true in the most successful parts of the Cavendish, which historically had been the sort of atomic and nuclear parts originally, and then the low-temperature groups. I think that had been almost entirely homegrown.
I mean, so that wasn't something that that Martin began as a matter of policy?
No, not at all, I think.
Now, another aspect of the Cambridge group that has been commented on often is what's called secrecy,
mm-hmm.
unwillingness to bring out data. Why do you think this has come about? Is it because people get cheesed off about you ignoring what they do, and so therefore they feel like you're not communicated, and therefore you're being secretive, or...
I think there's been a, as far as other people are concerned, that some things they felt were actually withheld.
No, I'm talking about the 50s, and not getting up as far as the pulsars now. Or do you think this really only got going, this feeling, later on?
No, I think it dates from early days when... the groups really were rather separate, and I think Martin has always been against presenting preliminary sort of half-baked views of what you think you're in the midst of, and that you should wait until you've actually given it some serious consideration, and then you can tell people what you think. Now, that looked at from put in that way is in fact obviously a very responsible and attitude.
Right.
From the outside, that can look as though one's holding back the most exciting stuff until you've sewn it all up and there's nothing else for anybody else to do except applaud, or, which of course they're very unlikely to do in those circumstances.
So it's just a different style of how one goes about doing his research. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, the other thing which I imagine you've also gathered from talking to Martin is that, and that I think a lot of us have also absorbed to some degree, is the feeling that in doing science there's far too much goes on in the way of bandwagons, that, you know, that as soon as something's interesting everybody wants to do that. Now, Martin believes that that's absolutely the wrong way to do science, that, you should, you know, that in fact there is some actual merit in groups being somewhat isolated and actually pursuing their own ideas in their own ways, which will obviously be really very different from what other people are doing. And in this way, something new might emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And he held that very strongly, and I hold that to some degree, and that I prefer to work in a field where there aren't, which, you know, which other people actually aren't very interested in.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean, but I hesitate to bring this up, but someone that I interviewed about 6 weeks ago made this very same comment, namely Fred Hoyle. He has the same philosophy as your group does.
I see.
No, he said that since he's been away from the universities for 5 years or so,
yes.
He's come to realize what a tremendous bandwagon effect there is. And
yes.
He's really enjoying just not getting this latest hot stuff at coffee and
feeling pressure that
right.
that's what's important.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. Well, anything else that you'd like to comment on that covers the year up to the early 60s that you worked on yourself or some aspect of the group here at Cambridge?
Well, put like that, I can't remember anything, I think.
Okay, thank you very much. And that ends the interview with John Baldwin
in Cambridge on 9th June 1981.